Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Brian Fisher, and this is the Free Bruce Podcast. I'm joined, as always, with the namesake, Bruce Feldman. It's our first podcast of 2012, and we're back at it. Got a little crazy there with everything that was going on in January and February, but we're back, and it's good to be back and talking with you, Bruce. And I'm sure you're glad to get back from Indianapolis, where you're at the Combine.
Yeah, it was an interesting few days there, and you know, it's good to see how, you know, sometimes these guys who are college stars and what they're thought of by the people, quote unquote, at the next level, whereas you have other guys who are pretty far off the radar. And I think even diehard college football fans probably couldn't place some of these guys. And yet some of those other guys are the ones that the NFL really focuses in on at weeks like this. So, you know, it's a good week, and it's definitely different than anything else that I get to cover over the course of a year.
Lots of coverage on CBSSports.com, including our Eye on NFL blog, and Bruce had some. He filed several things on the Free Bruce blog, and check those out. Like I said, on CBSSports.com. But I guess to the listeners out there, what's the one thing that is different about covering the combine? Because, you know, a lot of it seems like it's just kind of an assembly line of these guys coming in and going out, running 40s and whatnot. But covering the event, what's different about it?
You know, I think the biggest thing that I notice is some of these stories, which, you know, most people who follow college football, much less cover it, you know a lot about these guys' background. You know, I remember sitting down at the table where, you know, what they do is they'll bring in players, every player who is working out there, whether it's a star or a guy who, you know, is very low profile guy. They will bring him into the media room. And so the high profile guys are the people that they think a lot of the media wants to talk to. We put up at a podium where there's microphones and everything else, or, you know, the bulk of those players will be put at a round table where there's, you know, sometimes there's only one reporter, and other times there's, you know, a dozen or 15. And so you get to see who's really thought of in high, you know, in big circles, and who doesn't get the podium treatment. And so in that regard, I remember at one point sitting across from Tank Carter, you know, the terrific TC linebacker, and, you know, a lot of people had written over the years about his, you know, his background with, you know, with BMX and everything else. And I think just to see how people are kind of discovering that some of those things, and even to a lesser extent, people are discovering RG3 has parents who were in the military. I didn't know that, you know, and some of the personality stuff that, I think people were surprised. A lot of people were surprised to find out Andrew Luck is in fact an outstanding athlete. Not that he's, you know, that they thought he was going to run like a 5.140 or something, you know. I think those things are kind of, you just kind of shrug your shoulders, and it's like, you don't want to say, well, where have you guys been on some of these stories? But there is an element of discovery to some of these things that I think people look at and go, well, of course, you know, this guy was this way or whatever, you know, that's what he was for four or five years. And, by the same token, you know, right after RG3 is holding court, you know, in front of a couple hundred reporters, you know, Kellen Moore kind of basically anonymously just kind of discreetly walks into the media room, and there's really only a handful of reporters who are around him. And then, you know, not that far away from him, there's a receiver from Appalachian State, a really good looking 6'5", 220-pound receiver who a lot of college football fans have probably never heard of, who's probably fielding more questions than Kellen Moore was. And Kellen Moore, obviously all-time winningest quarterback in college football, by any definition. I mean, this guy's going to be a Hall of Fame player at the college level. But when it comes to the NFL, you know, not a great quote-unquote athlete on, you know, he's not going to test well. He's, you know, just 6 feet, as he said, just barely 6 feet, under 200 pounds, didn't run a good 40. But, you know, he said, watch, you know, take a look back at my film. And I think the bigger thing is take a look at the results he got. And that's what is intriguing to me about the combine. You do have an element of production versus potential that people are trying to sort out.
I always thought with the combine, especially nowadays, I think it serves to either reinforce certain things or to cause the NFL scouts to go back and look at something. You know, someone runs a faster than expected 40. All right, well, I'm going to go take a look at the film a little bit closer. Was there anybody there that maybe surprised you in terms of how they did based on what they did in college?
You know, I would have thought Kendall Wright would have run faster. He did not test great, you know, dynamic receiver at Baylor, who's a really explosive athlete and had a great career. You know, I would have thought he would run in the high 4.3s or low 4.4s. He was considerably slower than that, which, again, that surprised me. There was a couple of guys that I thought, you know, for the most part, the tests were kind of what I figured they would be. I did not expect Dontari Poe, who had been a guy that I've, you know, written about for over a year now and just heard about from people at Memphis what a physical freak he is. But to see a 346-pound guy running the 4.9s is just jaw-dropping. And, you know, so from talking to guys who've faced him and guys who coached against him in Conference USA in the last, you know, couple of days, it's interesting to hear their reaction. And you're right, ultimately people are gonna try to put as best a picture as they can, whether it comes down to the film or the workouts, and a lot of this is projecting. You know, you have guys who are in systems that they're not going to be in when they're trying to make it at the NFL level, and you're trying to figure out how much better they can get technique wise and develop and mature and everything else. But it's a fascinating process because you can get really excited about somebody who, I use the example of Tommy Streeter, who is a guy who came out a year early at Miami, a 6'5", almost 220-pound receiver, who, if you see him, and anybody who's ever been around Miami's practice facilities in the last couple of years, have like, who is that? You know, he's not Calvin Johnson, but there aren't many who look like this kid. And he's a guy who he was officially clocked at 4.40 at one point. I think he was in the low 4.3s. He can jump and he can really run, but it's really raw. And he's basically a one-year guy because he matured and had a big junior year and put up some numbers for them, but really hadn't done anything before that. And I think the NFL is going to look at it and go on, is this a guy who the light is just starting to come on? Because he's still fairly raw. Or is this a guy that is going to tease us with potential and really never be a guy who starts and maybe just be a fourth receiver? And I think you wonder, I mean, with athleticism like this, he's a guy who shouldn't get out of the second round with the potential. But you wonder, why hasn't it clicked for him sooner? Was he just starting to flash, and he's so raw that, you know, the route running and some of those things, why weren't they not there earlier? And all that stuff fits into why these debates that they're going to be having in NFL war rooms over the next, you know, over the next couple of months.
And Dontari Poe from Memphis also put up 44 reps at 225, which was the most in the combine. So very impressive week for him. And, you know, the NFL draft as a whole is always interesting to follow from a college perspective. But getting a sense of talking with the NFL coaches and whatnot, how do they evaluate players differently? And you kind of mentioned it a little bit in terms of projection. How do they evaluate differently from, say, college guys evaluating high school guys?
Well, I think they're much more concerned about the issues off the field and everything else. I think that if a guy has some red flags, their intel is much more in tune than what you have with college coaches. Now, what's interesting to me about that is if a guy gets into a bar fight in the NFL, there's not like widespread panic as there seems to be if it's an NFL, if it's a college guy, because it's so much more of a reputational thing, whether, you know, people know how many arrests Urban Meyer had at Florida, or, you know, as an example, and some of these things, whether it's a minor in possession or a DUI or a bar fight or what have you. But ultimately, they're looking for, in the NFL, it's accountability and who's a headache and is he going to be mature enough, because it's a full-time job. And I think where I'm going with this is, because it's a full-time job, does this guy have the capacity is he this committed to be a professional? In with college, you, I don't think they can really get a great sense of it. I mean, they know that some, you know, who's into it and who's not and everything else. But the do you love football or not? I think that's the big element with in the college recruiting side of things. But with the NFL, because it's such a job and because the level of understanding, especially at certain positions, I think that's where guys look at it and go, you know, we got to really find out what's in this kid's head. What does he understand? What kind of concepts can he grasp? And that's an interesting dynamic to see, as opposed to, you know, in college, as they're making the transition, I think they can make guys work and guys can succeed, just because a lot of times the guy across from them physically is nowhere near as gifted as maybe these kind of NFL caliber players are. Where at the next level, you know, the margin for error is so much smaller.
A lot of mock drafts up on CBSSports.com. You can look at everybody and see where they slot in. Obviously, Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III, those are the two guys that everybody's kind of talking about. But outside of those two quarterbacks, if you had to pick somebody that a lot of people are expecting to go in the first round, is there anybody out there that you in particular think, you know what, that guy is going to be a 10-year Pro Bowler? I just know it. You know, you kind of have it in the back of your mind that, you know what, this guy is so solid at the college level, he's going to translate real well in the NFL?
I mean, a 10-year Pro Bowler is a mouthful. I'm not, you know, I think Andrew Luck's great, and I think he's about the only, you know, I'm not sure, you know, as good as the top two guys are, to think 10-year Pro Bowler, that's such a big thing.
Okay, well, we'll rein it in a little bit. Okay, someone who out there is going to be consistent?
If a guy could start for 6 years, maybe that's a little more, and maybe go to a Pro Bowl, because honestly, the guy who probably has the best chance to become the third quarterback taken, I would guess, is Ryan Tannehill, because of his physical skills. But he's also a guy who really hasn't played that much quarterback in college. You know, so you wonder, and again, not necessarily a one-year wonder, but you wonder where he is at in terms of consistency. I mean, he's a guy, if he goes in the top 15 picks, you know, there's definitely a boom or bust quality to him, where if I could see, if it doesn't, you know, if things don't take off for him, people are going to go, I could, you know, why did they jump on him? Just because he used to be a receiver and is pretty athletic. And, you know, so I think that one's, they're all risky to take a quarterback in the first round, because quarterbacks, usually if they don't turn out to be great, you know, it sets you back, because you're invested and you don't draft them, you know, every 2 or 3 years. I could see a guy like Kirk Cousins, if he's a mid-second round, late-second round guy. I mean, he's not going to wow you with his physical skills, but is a very mature, very grounded, very competitive kid. And he, to me, now he's not as good a runner as Andy Dalton, but I do see a lot of personality, a lot of similarities in their personalities. And I think he throws it, you know, well enough. I think he's just a guy who I think is just very solid in every aspect. Again, I don't think he's quite as good a runner as Andy Dalton, but I do see some similarities between them. Another one who's a boom or bust guy, I think, is Brock Osweiler. I would think you're talking about a guy, whether he's 6'7" or 6'8", and that was discussed at the combine. You know, his arm is really good. He's still really raw. He can move better than a lot of guys, much less a lot of guys who are over 6'5". I mean, there's a lot to work with. He's a very confident kid, which, you know, I think that's going to bode well for him. But, you know, again, he's a guy who I think tools-wise people could get overexcited about, whereas they look at it in terms of production. You know, whereas you have a guy like, let's say, Nick Foles, but has very good size, is a bright kid. He's a tough, you know, he's a tough kid, but not a, you know, not a kid who's, you know, a guy who's going to necessarily be abrasive or anything like that. I think he's a guy who has a chance to surprise some people, because the buzz on him now seems to be a little lower than it was 6 months ago.
All right, well, let me clarify a little bit, just for you. Who, not necessarily a quarterback, but I guess safe picks, you know, because I look at, you know, David DeCastro out of Stanford, Matt Khalil out of USC, Luke Kuechly, those type of guys that I think would be safe picks and are going to be 10-year, you know, they're going to spend 10-plus years in the league and they're just going to be solid. which of those guys out there might people be overlooking a little bit?
Meaning of that group of the Khalils and of
just a solid guy that's out there that you think is maybe not being talked about, maybe someone, you know, a Jarrell Worthy or someone that had a pretty productive college career that you think is going to translate well in the NFL.
All right, let me give a little bit of thought on this, because I mean, I think you're talking about a guy who's either probably a late first round guy or somebody like that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it could be a Mo Claiborne, who's definitely going to be probably the first corner taken off the board, if not a top five pick himself. I mean, I think you could maybe consider him. You know, I think does have a little bit of that, you know, 1 year wonder with the season that he had this past year. But, I think he would be a solid pick.
Yeah, I would agree. I would think he would. I think Dante Hightower is a guy who I'm surprised he's not gotten people a little more excited. I mean, he's a 265-pound guy. He's played a lot of football, was very well coached, pretty explosive kid, has battled some injuries. But I think he's a guy, if he's a late first rounder, I think you got a good player there. Another one that's interesting to me, and I don't know whether he's going to be in the first round or not, but I heard, you know, maybe he's a late first rounder, is Fletcher Cox from Mississippi State. And I talked to guys who coach him. He's, again, playing at a high level. I think he's a guy who will be a really good NFL player. He's a bright kid. I think he's very athletic. He still can, you know, he moves a lot better than you would think for a guy that big. Another defensive lineman that kind of got my attention this week, and he had a pretty good year at Clemson, was Andre Branch. And there's something about him. He definitely has a little bit of a spark to him, and I think he's a guy who could end up making a lot of plays in the NFL. Just in terms of, you know, he gave Virginia Tech fits this year when they played up in Blacksburg in midseason. I just think he's a guy who the best football is ahead of him. So, you know, in terms maybe slightly below the top 15. I think those are guys that really jump out at me.
Didn't want to go all about the draft in this podcast because obviously we're moving into spring ball and that's sort of starting in the next couple weeks. A couple teams like Texas and Texas Tech have already started their practices. Is there one storyline this offseason and this spring in particular you're looking to follow or maybe something that stands out that might be related to a guy that's going to get drafted?
Well, I think there's things you want to see about how some of these, you know, how some of these quarterback battles, and I wrote about this today on the site, just how, you have a place with three or four guys, how it's going to sort out. Because if you take a look, whether it's Brian Kelly at Notre Dame, I think so much for his future at Notre Dame is hinged on having one guy emerge right now. I mean, this is his third year, and the expectations, I think, were high last year, and they're always going to be fairly high at Notre Dame, but I think people, the way they finished 2010, got really excited, thought this really should be a BCS bowl team, and it wasn't. And they finished with kind of a thud, and quarterback play was definitely a big disappointment, especially considering he had a terrific receiver in Michael Floyd and a very good tight end, and quality backs, and it wasn't like that inexperienced offensive line, and it didn't work, and Tommy Rees struggled, and obviously Dane Crist struggled, and he's gone, and I from talking to Brian Kelly, and we had him on our signing day show, he really raved about Everett Golson. You could hear him perk up, and I want to see what he does. Now he's got Gunnar Kiel is already there, and there's big expectations on him. Well, if one of these guys, if nobody emerges there, I think this is going to be an interesting development, because I do think Brian Kelly is the right coach there, and I'm not sure that he'll ever win a national title, but I think at some point Notre Dame has to get closer to being a legitimate top 15, top 10 team, not just a team that kind of can surface up there, and then whenever they play somebody really good, you know, it exposes them. And so I want to see how good Everett Golson really is. I've heard a lot of good things. They need somebody who can really be a catalyst. And I don't think they've had one of those at quarterback for quite some time. They've had guys who've been productive, you know, whether it was Jimmy Clausen or Quinn, but in terms of just a guy who can really be the front man of the program, you wonder if this is that kid. Or who knows, maybe Gunnar Kiel will be that guy. But that's a battle. You know, I want to see who takes over at Oregon, because, you know, Darren Thomas had a lot of success. He surprised people by leaving. Now they have two guys who are as athletic, if not more athletic, maybe more accurate. And I talked to Darren Thomas about the two of them. We'll see how Brian Bennett, if he really takes over, because this is a team that just won the Rose Bowl. I mean, they have a legitimate shot, you know, with DeAnthony Thomas and a lot of good skill guys still returning. They have a shot to be a BCS title contender now. I mean, that's the next step for them. But can they get really good, consistent quarterback play from two young guys right now? And so those are all the things. You know, you have Florida. They have two athletic young quarterbacks with a new offensive coordinator, and want to see if they can get back to being close to where Florida was just a few years ago. And that, to me, is what we get in the spring is who are these guys who are going to ready to lead? You know, if you just, it hit me that about a year ago at this time, nobody knew who was going to be a starting quarterback in Alabama. We thought it might be McCarron, or, you know, some people thought Sims might be a little better thrower. And it turned out it was McCarron, and it turned out McCarron had a great BCS title game and led him to a national championship. And you never know what you're going to get. But that definitely is such a key position in college football that'll be the development to keep an eye on.
I was curious, looking at your top 10 list that you did on the site, number 1 and number 10 I thought were a little interesting placement. Number 1, you have Oregon with Bennett and Mariota, and then number 10 you have Texas A&M kind of at the bottom. Obviously, it's going to be interesting to see A&M, new offensive system, new head coach. A lot of those guys are dual threat guys, and they're in, you know, coming into a new league. I was curious why you had the Aggies so low. They're behind Auburn and Florida and Texas and some other powers. And then why, you know, you mentioned a little bit why Oregon was so high in terms of being a BCS team, but, you know, do you see the Ducks battle being a little bit closer than a lot of people think?
I do. You know, just from talking to a lot of people inside the program and as well as Darren Thomas a couple of days ago, you know, they think they have two really, really good options there. And Bennett's, you know, as Thomas told me, he said Bennett is more prone, more, you know, kind of wired to be a runner. But both guys can run, and both guys have good arms. It's just obviously the experience and reps in that offense at warp speed is a challenge. But, you know, Chip Kelly's a phenomenal coach when it comes to getting a team ready and offense ready. So we'll see how that plays out. I mean, they're going to hit the ground running. But, you know, as far as Texas A&M, was just down there a few days ago, and I don't know how well they're going to do in the first year, because – they did lose a lot of good players, and they weren't, you know, they lost a ton of close games in a lesser conference. Now they're going into the SEC, new coaching staff. I think Kevin Sumlin put together a great staff from top to bottom. And Cliff Kingsbury, to me, is a rising star in coaching. He's got four guys. Now, they're in this air raid system or variation of it, there really hasn't been somebody run it who can run it like three of the guys he has now. And the fourth guy is Matt Jokel, Luke's brother, who's more of a pocket guy. But the other guys, Jameel Showers is an athletic kid. He's this pretty thick kid who can throw and run. And then Johnny Manziel, who, if you talk to people around the state, they all light up about him, because he's a guy who's not very tall. He had actually been committed to Oregon for a while, 6 feet. You know, big hands, big feet, very great, very good runner, very slick in terms of, you know, kind of has a Doug Flutie kind of style about him, you know, explosive and athlete enough that even at 6 feet, he can do a 300, you know, 360 dunk and he can throw it, and he can make plays on the run. And I'm curious to see what they do with these guys. He's got options to make a lot of things happen. And obviously the offense won't be as diverse, I don't know if diverse is the right way, but just have all the bells and whistles that it had when they were at Houston, because Case Keenum was a sixth-year guy, and whereas you're having really a first-year starter take it over. But they have a good running back, and they have, you know, Ryan Swope is a really good receiver, and I think the big thing that people need to remember with Texas A&M is they're going to have one of the best offensive lines in the country. So that will help the first-year starter and the coaching staff kind of transition in. When you have an offensive line as good and the experience as they have, it can cover up a lot of things.
Did want to transition into our guest, Brett McMurphy, and you know him very well from CBSSports.com. He's a senior columnist on the site, and I guess we could change the name now, Brett, to the Sources Podcast after having you on. Welcome, what podcast?
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be with you guys.
Hey, Brett, just to start out, obviously there's been a lot of discussion from some really powerful people in college athletics over the last month or so. You were just in Dallas with a lot of those power brokers were at the meetings. Where do you think this is all headed in terms of playoff? Because it seems like, you know, a lot of us are excited that it sounds like there's some traction to this thing.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the barn door's open as far as a playoff, so that's going to happen. You know, what form it's going to take, that's still to be unknown. You know, we reported last week that a 8-team and 16-team playoff has not even been discussed. It's off the radar. They don't feel comfortable going to that many teams. So you're basically going to look at two models. One is a seeded 4-team playoff, 1 versus 4, 2 versus 3, which obviously has been reported more frequently than the other possibility, and that's simply a +1, meaning one additional game after the bowls are over. I think if they do that format, I think that's the least likely of the two, because if you did that, then you would basically just have the conference champions go to whatever bowl they're tied into. You wouldn't have a 1 versus 2 matchup anymore, and then once all the bowls had been played, then whatever the top two teams are would meet in a one game final. I think most people are intrigued by the seeded 1 versus 4, 2 versus 3, but that's not simple because you've got, you know, Jim Delaney and Larry Scott. Obviously, they're tag teaming on this, and they want the semifinals to be held on campus. And then you've got others who have remarked that, you know, well, the Final Fours not held on campus sites, and they would rather those semifinal games be held either involving the bowls or some of these other college football venues that don't have currently a BCS bowl games. Dallas, Atlanta, Indianapolis, you know, could simply bid for those games, and the games would be awarded to the highest bidder. So Bruce, I think we're definitely going to have some sort of +1, and I think it'll be a seeded 4-team playoff, but don't call it a playoff or then they may cancel the whole thing. But you know, whether that's going to involve the bowl games or just be neutral sites or even campus sites for the semifinals, you know, all that stuff still has to be determined. The commissioners are going to meet again in late March in Dallas, and then they're going to meet again in April and down in Fort Lauderdale.
Brett, why do you think that if you go through this system and the process comes down to what they are now saying is conference champions as opposed to maybe the top four seeded teams, do you think that is directly, you know, without them saying a reaction to trying to minimize the dominance that the SEC has had?
Yeah, Bruce, I would think so. I guess they figure if you're the Pac-12 or the Big Ten and they're the ones you know, that appear to support only conference champions qualifying. Obviously, you know, Dennis Dodd, who we work with at CBS, wrote that Roy Kramer, who basically is the grandfather of the BCS, he also is in favor of only conference champions qualifying for this 4-team playoff. But if you're the Pac-12 or Big Ten, it makes a huge amount of sense why you would want this. Because you simply look at the other conferences that are out there, and okay, the SEC is always going to have a team in the top four, and so basically, then you're battling the ACC, the Big 12, you know, or the Big East, or whatever conference USA Mountain West ends up becoming, and so there's probably a pretty good bet that the Big Ten and the Pac-12 will get two of those four spots every year. At worst, they would get one of the four, and I think it would, you know, it would be a real freaky year if they didn't qualify any of the top four. You know, but again, what's interesting, which, you know, we talked about a minute ago, is how you're going to incorporate all these into the bowl games. And Jim Delaney has, you know, he said in New York back in December at the IMG forum, he said, whatever format takes place, he goes, if you guys can guarantee me that we will still be tied into the Rose Bowl, the Big Ten and the Pac-12 being tied into the Rose Bowl. He goes, I'll sign on for anything, in which Conference USA Commissioner Britton Banowski immediately said, can we get that in writing? So, you know, if you go to conference champions only, then you take out the very real possibility that you could, that half of the field would be from the SEC. And I think, you know, realistically, although I don't know if they'd ever admit it publicly, but I'm sure the Big Ten and Pac-12 feels it would be take a really, really special year for them ever to have two of the top four teams in the country, you know, being as part of the plus one, although I guess they were close this past year with Oregon and Stanford.
Brett, one of the other things that our colleague Dennis Dodd reported was that the BCS was close to hiring some media consultants, and pretty much everybody's out there saying this could be a longer-term deal than we're used to. Is this going to end up being a system we're going to have for 10 years or 12 years or something like that?
Yeah, Brian, I really think so. And the reason is, and they've talked about this before, and they call it bracket creep, and what, you know, basically they don't want a 4-team playoff growing to 8 teams or 16 teams in 4 years, 8 years, whatever the amount of time is. And, you know, based on, you know, history, they do have a point, because if you look at any sport, whether it's professional or college, whether it's the NCAA basketball tournament, Major League Baseball, the NFL, hockey, NBA, whatever number of teams you started out that playoff with, however far back, you know, every so often you would keep increasing the playoff field. It would keep growing. It would keep growing. That is their number one fear, I think, about going to this plus one, is to be able to guarantee that it doesn't go beyond four teams, because they feel if it does go beyond four teams to 8 or 16 or whatever, it would devalue the regular season even more, which that's their big rallying cry, you know, the most meaningful regular season. So that's why they want to do a long-term deal. And if they do lock in, you know, 10 years, 12 years, 15, whatever they're going to do, that would basically lock in four teams for that amount of time. The playoff would never be able to grow unless they broke up the contract, which obviously they put a lot of language in there that they couldn't do it. But they will be able to go in and do what they call look-ins every 4 or 5 years to go back in and reassess the value of the deal. So that doesn't mean they're going to be stuck on the numbers, financial numbers, that they first negotiate. But they will be able to go back and look in and increase the value of the media rights deal if warranted. But then they would still keep the field would remain four teams. And I think that's their greatest fear of getting in any type of plus one, is this thing morphing into some 16-team playoff like they have on the FCS level.
Brett, you have been all over the conference realignment stories, and so much of the, I think you're like literally in the Big East office at sometimes. You've been that on top of it. What's the role of kind of the non-power conferences, the Big East, whatever becomes of the Mountain West? How do they view this shifting landscape, and how much of a part of it are they going to be going forward?
I mean, Brian, that's a great question, and that's a great unknown. You know, they really don't know, and, you know, there's talk about, are they going to get rid of the BCS AQ conferences, which the Big East is one of six right now. You know, that won't change until the 2014 regular season, if it does change. You know, but the one question that I haven't seen anyone answer is, if you go ahead and get away with the AQ BCS conferences, which there has been some talk about doing, then basically you'd have 10 or 11 conferences, depending on if Conference USA and the Mountain West merges or not. So you'd have 10 or 11 conferences that in theory are all equal conferences. They're all, whatever you want to call them, they're all BCS conferences, or they're all non-BCS conferences. However, when they divide up all the revenue of the BCS, like they currently do, the way they currently do it is the AQ conferences get more money than the non-AQ conferences. So if you're going to make all these conferences in theory equal, you know, I don't think anybody's expecting the Sun Belt or the MAC to get the same amount of revenue as the SEC or the Pac-12. So how are you going to change that? How are you going to make them supposedly equal conferences, but then award you know, an equal amount of revenue. That's one thing I haven't seen answered, and I think that's going to be the biggest challenge on how they figure out this BCS format going forward in 2014. You know, but bottom line, you know, there's been a lot of, I've seen rumors. I can't tell you how many people ask me this on Twitter, you know, seemingly every day. And that's, hey, I hear Boise and San Diego State, you know, they're holding out that the Mountain West may get an AQ exemption and they'd be an AQ conference the next 2 years. And that now they're having second thoughts on going to the Big East because there won't be AQ conferences. Even if there are not AQ conferences, in the BCS, being in the Big East will still be worth three or four times more as far as media rights revenue than staying back in the Mountain West or staying in Conference USA. So for all the people that think that, you know, that hear that Boise and San Diego State are not going to the Big East, you know, I've heard the complete opposite. You know, simply money-wise, it makes more sense for them to move to the Big East. And obviously there's an uncertain future in the Big East. There's an uncertain future in Mountain West and Conference USA. But, you know, I guess the one thing that is certain is that there's going to continue to be uncertainty. And, you know, the bottom line is anytime there's movement above the Big East with the other five BCS conferences, it's going to trickle down and it's going to affect the Big East. It's going to affect the Mountain West and it's going to affect Conference USA. And that's unfortunate, because basically all these conferences now, they're just trying to find a way to survive and try to get to 2014 and survive and see what kind of model, you know, college football has then.
Brett, one of the schools you always hear about potentially being on the move is Louisville. A year from now, where do you think they're aligned with? Or who do you think they're aligned with, which conference?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple, Bruce. And, we've reported this numerous times. It boils down to this. When the Big 12 decides to expand to 11 teams, Louisville will be in the Big 12. So the obvious question is, will the Big 12 expand to 11 teams or more? You know, that's something they've got to decide. They're going to name a new commissioner by July 1st. You know, I'm sure he'll get with the expansion committee and they'll figure out if they want to stay at 10 or if they want to go to 11 or if they want to go to 12. The only way that it's not Louisville as an 11th member is if somehow Notre Dame has a change of heart and decides that it wants to join a conference, and somehow they could recruit Notre Dame as a Big 12 member, either as a football, you know, all sports member, including football, which I think is doubtful. Or maybe if they can convince Notre Dame that they'd be better off, you know, in the Big 12 with their Olympic sports like they currently are in the Big East and then remain an independent in football. But, you know, when the Big 12 decided on West Virginia, it was basically, you know, almost split down the middle between West Virginia and Louisville, but West Virginia got the slight nod. So, you know, it's simply if, when the Big 12 decides that they do want to go to 11, if they want to do that, it will be Louisville. No mistake, Louisville will accept that invitation, and they'll be in the Big 12. And I think that's part of the reason, you know, I've been told that's part of the reason that the Big East has gone after Temple, not only to bring them in 2012, so the Big East has eight football-playing members, but also when Navy joins in 2015, if they don't have any more defections, they would be up to 13 football members in 2015. If they lose Louisville, then they're at 12, which was their initial goal when all the changes started happening.
Since we're going, getting ahead of ourselves with everything, I want to go further off the map. I've always thought that 14 is an odd number for the SEC and some of these other things. And I know the talking to people out here on the West Coast, the Pac-12, you know, people in power really aren't that comfortable with expanding dramatically anymore. And I think that's kind of put the brakes on things out here. But do you see it being inevitable that there will be a lot more moves? It seems like for the most part on the outside of the Big East level schools, a lot of these with the Big Ten, unless Notre Dame's going to move somewhere, you know, whatever's going on with Texas and Oklahoma, it seems like that's settled or at least tabled for a little while until we get to find out which direction the Big 12 is headed in. Do you think that at some point, you know, 2 years from now, we're going to get another wave of some big schools on the move?
You know, Bruce, I think that the main thing that will cause that is if the leagues determine that they need the revenue of going to, you know, 14 teams in the Pac-12, you know, in the case of the Pac-12, or if they go to 16 teams. But I really think that it's actually after the Big 12 decides what they're going to do, and then if they take some teams in the Big East, you know, responds and does whatever they need to do to fill those holes, I actually think it's going to slow down. The only exception to that is if, you know, Notre Dame, they're obviously the holy grail in this whole thing. If they ever decide that they're going to go to another conference, either as a just for their Olympic sports or in remain independent of football or as an all sports member, then I think wherever they go, whether it's the Big Ten, the Big 12, the ACC, wherever they end up, I then think the other BCS leagues will react to that and then try to get up to 16, kind of to combat Notre Dame joining another league. But if Notre Dame is happy with the Big East for their Olympic sports and being football independent, which I've heard, you know, nothing that says that they're not, then I actually think it's going to slow down, because the Pac-12, you know, unless they can ever get Texas and Oklahoma to make the jump, there really are no teams out there that they can add that add value to the league. I mean, they can find two or four teams, but those teams are not going to increase the amount of value per team that they currently have with 12 members. The Big Ten set, you know, they're set with 12. The only way they would expand is if they get Notre Dame. The ACC's at 14. You know, I would argue that the ACC, if they knew the Pac-12 was going to stay at 12 and not go to 16, because remember, it was just a couple years ago, we thought those guys were, Texas and Oklahoma were leaving. They were going to go to 16, and the thinking was, well, the Big Ten and SEC would have to react and go to 16. And so I think the ACC saw the end game, in which I think they were correct, is that then the Big East and ACC would battle for that fourth 16-team conference. So the ACC took the initiative. They were proactive. They went out and got two Big East schools, but then a funny thing happened, and nothing happened with the Pac-12. So now they're at 14. I don't think they would go to 16 because they can't increase the revenue per team inside the league. You know, I think the Big 12 won't go past 12. And obviously the SEC, you know, is a unique chance for them to get into the state of Texas to get Texas A&M. They had to have a team pair up with Texas A&M. That's why they got Missouri, because they've got a, you know, from what I've been told, they've got a gentleman's agreement that they will not take an existing school from a state that already has an existing member. So that's why a lot of schools that initially were mentioned, Florida State, Clemson, Georgia Tech, on, weren't really considered, because the SEC already has teams in those states. So if you, you know, throw all that together in a blender, I think that basically, you know, once the Big 12 gets done, once the Big East, you know, reloads again, then I think we're actually going to be set for a while. And, you know, the two exceptions are if Notre Dame makes a change of heart and wants to get into a different league, and or the presidents determine that they've got to increase their membership to 16, basically to increase the revenue. And that's basically why we're going, you know, going back to our initial question, that's kind of why we're headed to a plus one, you know, because of the revenue.
Brett, wanted to get you out on this question. You've written a little bit about this and are going to write more on it. The requirement to have a better than 500 record, how close is that to happening? And do you see that, you know, being something that affects the bowl system as a whole in terms of, you know, cutting bowls or whatever it might be?
Yeah, Brian, it's I think it's coming. You know, 2014 is the earliest it would happen, although it's separate from the BCS plus one. What they have to determine with that, it is kind of intertwined. But basically, they want to reel the BCS final back from January 9th or 10th to closer to January 1st. So if you're looking at ending the title game at January 4th or 5th or whatever it is, you know, are you still going to play the GoDaddy.com Bowl and what I can't even name them all that are played at, you know, after January 1st? Excuse me, after January 5th, you know, in Dallas, I did talk to a number of the commissioners. I'm writing something next week for CBSSports.com about their thoughts on if they should increase bowl eligibility from simply 6-6 to 7-5, because before 2006, you had to have a winning record. But of course, back then we only played 11 games, but you had to go 6-5 to get a bowl, bid. Then they added the 12th game, and then they allowed 6-6 teams to get in. You added 4 or 5 bowl games. So, of all the commissioners I talked to, not one commissioner said they were against going to 7-5. But there are a lot of, you know, details that have to be worked out, because you can't, if you increase the bowl eligibility to 7-5, in the past 2 years there were 27 teams, almost 1/5 of the bowl field was 6-6. So obviously you're going to have to cut a lot of bowls, anywhere from 4 to 10, I think, are the estimates. And you can't simply just cut a bowl. Obviously there's a lot of stuff that goes into that, but if there's not enough eligible teams, you've got to do something. So I think the commissioners want to increase the bowl eligibility to 7 wins, you know, but they, a couple of them did say, you know, I haven't discussed this with my membership, but this is what I want to do. And these are the power conferences, the Big Six conferences too, which benefit the most from these 6-6 bowl games. But their biggest problem is, you know, hearing it from their athletic directors is, you know, I've got, you know, my school's going 6-6, and that's a subpar season. And, you know, here I am having to go to a bowl game that my fan base doesn't want to go to, is not excited to go to. And also, you know, quite frankly, some of these coaches get fired for going 6-6. You know, the Kraft Fight Hunger Bowl, both Illinois and UCLA coaches were both fired, you know, after they're going 6-6. And then also on top of that, the ADs have to pay these coaches bonuses for qualifying for a bowl game, and that's whether they're 11-1 and 6-6. So I think those are a number of the reasons why they want to increase it to 7-5, but it's not going to be just that simple as saying you have to have a winning record anymore, because believe me, you're going to hear some heavy lobbying from all the bowls about, you know, they need to keep it 6-6 and let all the players experience a bowl trip and all that. But I even had some ADs tell me, you know, that they're even tired of it. They called it, you know, bowl fatigue. And it's, you know, it's like having all these players go to these bowls and play in these half empty stadiums, which basically were just created for television programming, has gotten old. And there's not a lot of people that are in favor of this, you know, but it's not simply going to be increasing bowl eligibility. There's a lot of, you know, moving parts to this, but I do think they'll figure out a way to do it. And somehow that'll be intertwined with whatever format they decide to do with the plus one playoff.
Great stuff as always, Brett. Be sure to, for everybody out there, to catch all your work on the McMurphy's Law blog on CBSSports.com, as well as all your columns and whatnot. And we will revert the name back next week, back to the Free Bruce podcast. But for right now, it's the Sources podcast with Bruce Feldman and Brett McMurphy. And we'll catch you next week.